I would be banging on the White House door saying, Mr. President, would you tell me again, please, why my son was killed in Baghdad?
The president lied. Now, a government official lying in the conduct of carrying out the responsibilities of his office, that's fraud. And fraud, under federal statutes, is a felony.
We oppose U.S. policy towards Korea because it deprives us of the right to live peacefully and suppresses our right to self-determination.
Some 10,000 Afghans have been killed, really, since November 2001.
Most of the other things that Poindexter's crowd has been doing is ranges from the ghoulish to the terrifying.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, July 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The CIA has determined the latest audio message purportedly from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, in which he marks the deaths of his sons, is most likely authentic. The CIA's technical analysis of the message matched very closely with other recordings of Saddam's voice, a CIA official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity. The voice on the message said it was made in July 2003, but the exact date was not clear. CIA officials aren't certain of the exact date the recordings were made, but the references to the July 22nd deaths of Saddam's sons, Uday and Qusay, mean it was almost certainly made during the last week. For all the uncertainty during the war, American officials now hold little doubt that Saddam is alive and in Iraq, perhaps moving every few days. The audio messages making references to recent events are evidence of his survival. In the latest 9-minute audio tape, Saddam said he was glad his sons were killed because such a death, quote, is the hope of every fighter. He went on to say, even if Saddam Hussein has 100 sons other than Uday and Qusay, Saddam Hussein would offer them the same path. The voice on the tape said, that is the hope of every fighter for God's sake, as another group of noble souls of the martyrs has ascended to their creator. Israel is proposing a troop pullout from two more Palestinian towns in the wake of meetings between the two sides' leaders and President Bush, officials said today. The pullout, along with the release of Palestinian prisoners and Israeli security barrier going up along the West Bank and Israel's demand to dismantle Palestinian groups labeled as violent, were on the agenda at a meeting late today between Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz and Mohammed Dahlan, the Palestinian minister in charge of security. Palestinians were disappointed with the results of the Bush-Sharon summit. Contending the president took Israel's side on the outstanding issues, Bush seemed to back off criticism of the security barrier and supported Israel's position that Palestinian prisoners accused of terrorism could not be released. He also called on Palestinians to dismantle the groups labeled as violent. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, the Pentagon office that proposed spying electronically on Americans to prevent potential acts of terrorism, came up with a new scheme earlier this week to predict where terrorists would likely strike next. They announced plans to launch a futures trading market where investors could wage bets on the probability of political events and actions, such as North Korea launching a missile strike or Al-Qaeda attacking the U.S. again. Members of Congress, including Republican Ted Stevens of the Senate Appropriations Committee, were quick to criticize the measure.
It is totally unauthorized as far as we're concerned. It's not, no funds should have been used for it at all. And it's really a serious mistake on the part of DARPA. I think it may well jeopardize DARPA in the future. If they're not going to live up to the concept of reprogramming, we'll have to watch more carefully over them. That's all there is to it.
Also critical of the plans was Democratic Senator Tom Daschle, the Senate Minority Leader.
I'm not satisfied with just a tepid cancellation of the program. I think they need to renounce it. They need to apologize to our military as well as to the families of 9/11 and all of those who may have been adversely affected by a market on terror as they have now proposed.
And Republican Pat Roberts of Kansas, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says that his committee received no prior notice of the plan.
This defies common sense. It's absurd. But if you don't have the specifics of a program, in your oversight responsibility in regards to authorization, or they don't even go to the appropriators, it seems to me that they are way off base and somebody should bear that responsibility, and I think we know who that is.
DARPA's plan to launch a futures trading market has since been withdrawn as a result of the firestorm of controversy. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with economist Doug Henwood, editor of the Left Business Review, to find out how the plan would have actually worked.
Well, I think an analogy is there's the University of Iowa runs a political futures market on presidential candidates every campaign season. I think that's kind of an analogy in that they're trying to get some sense of how speculators view, you know, something in the political realm. We're not talking about, you know, conventional commodities or financial instruments that trade according to their own lights, but this is, you know, trying to bring market trading into the political realm. And mm-hmm. I think it's utterly demented. At least with commodities or financial instruments, you're talking about the things themselves. I mean, we're talking about demand for gold or demand for oil or the supply of treasury bonds or something like that. The market prices actually bear some relation to the actual trade in the good or service or whatever. This is trying to harness, you know, the collective wisdom of speculators, which is a very dubious quantity anyway, and try to get some prediction of the future. And this seems to take a faith in the wisdom of investors and speculators and the wisdom of market pricing to a whole new levels of madness.
So how would it work exactly? What would they do?
Well,
give us an example of a bet someone might place.
Someone might make, you know, Al-Qaeda will attack Washington, you know, somebody would say, sure, I'll take that bet, and then somebody else will say, no, nah, it's not going to happen, they'll take the other side of the bet. I don't think they'd actually worked out the details of the contracts or anything like that, but, you know, it's essentially they're trying to rate the probabilities of something happening by having investors come in and buy or sell contracts in the likelihood of something happening. There are analogies, you know, there are storm futures contracts and things like that, and you can certainly buy a derivative, an over-the-counter derivative that will cover just about anything. The average temperature in London for the next 6 months or something like that. If you could find somebody else to take the other side of the trade, they'll do that. There are some, you know, precedents in the financial mm-hmm. world for this sort of thing. But
so you say the other side of the trade, but it's really the other side of the bet. Someone's got a bet against you that Al-Qaeda is not going to attack the U.S.
Right,
again,
you
example.
You need somebody to, you know, it takes two to tango in this case.
And so you actually win money based on the outcome of the events?
That's the idea. You can't have a market that works very well unless people have real money at stake.
From a purely economic standpoint, how much sense did this plan make, and how good is the market at predicting world events?
Well, I don't think the market has much of a track record in predicting world events, but the market's track record in predicting market-related events is not all that great. We had in the summer of 1999, it looked like the dot-coms were going to take over the world, and we're going to have face a future of endless prosperity. The Nasdaq and all the dot-coms collapsed in the spring and summer of 2000, and suddenly the future looked very, very different. Now, so what had changed in the space of less than a year? It was just a matter of market perceptions and, you know, the long-term economic prospects of the long-term economic fundamentals hadn't really changed that much. It was just people's perceptions. So markets are notorious for taking extreme positions of either optimism or pessimism, and they're very volatile. They're much more volatile than the underlying economic fundamentals, and they show no particular wisdom. It's just an exaggerated version of how people feel at the present. That's what drives the markets. But market fundamentalists believe that market prices have almost a mystical power to predict the future. I think you really have to look at this as almost a kind of weird religion rather than anything economically rational.
So, okay, you said that there's no economic rationale behind this, and I'm wondering what kind of logic thought that it would be a good idea to bring these two concepts together.
I don't know the facts, but I suspect somebody who'd either was an academic in finance or somebody who'd been reading academic finance thought this was a really groovy idea that that people who, for example, Alan Greenspan constantly cites the wisdom of markets in when he was defending the market's wisdom during the stock market bubble, and now he's defending the market's wisdom during what might be a housing market bubble. That's just, you know, the default position of bureaucrats and pundits and academics who deal with finance. They think that the markets are much wiser than governments, and that they hope, I think, to harness some of that alleged wisdom. But you know, I certainly don't see it from my understanding of the markets. They are extremely volatile and emotional, not at all rational.
And what about the possibility that if this were to have been put in place and followed through on, that some of the bets could become self-fulfilling prophecies, that people with vested self-interest in the market might somehow involve themselves, you know, as awful as it seems, in making their predictions come true?
Well, it seems like a very, very great risk, because to make these predictions come true is not that that big a stretch. You couldn't, you know, if you're trading orange juice futures, there's no way that an individual trader could, like, destroy the whole orange juice crop and make a killing that way. Or, you know, you could say about, you know, there's no way somebody could corner the whole oil market and make a prediction or a self-fulfilling. But with a terrorist attack, you can certainly make something self-fulfilling, and that would create, as they say in the finance trade, this can create extremely perverse incentives.
You know, just how bizarre, out of the norm, unprecedented is this plan?
Completely. And I think most people who are not, you know, familiar with the world of finance look at some of the things that finance types propose or do and think, boy, this is really crazy. And, you know, after a little bit of exposure to it, some people come around and say, well, oh, it's not so crazy after all. It's pretty sensible. But I think the initial lay reaction is a good thing. I think this is completely insane. And that, you know, people who hold this faith in the wisdom of and prescience of markets are really, you know, it's a kind of superstition. It's insane, but because it has a great social prestige attached to it, it's never really called insane. But, you know, I think that reaction that you have, that this is pretty wacky and pretty out of far out of left field, is completely accurate. This is just nutty stuff. Makes no sense on any level at all. And
no upside.
No, I think it's completely insane. It just doesn't make any sense at all. It provides absolutely no new information and can only serve, I think, to either scare or people unnecessarily, or lull them into complacency unnecessarily. But I think, you know, I think the kinds of people who propose these things have very little faith in the wisdom of governments to make decisions, and so they think that somehow you can tap into the wisdom of the markets, but, you know, markets are certainly no wiser than governments, and probably less so.
So, Doug Henwood, you've described it as completely insane, utterly demented. Is it safe to say that you think it's a lot? It's pretty bullish or unbearable, or?
I think it's just further evidence that this office needs to be shut down as quickly as possible. I mean, this, you know, is laughable and ludicrous, and, you know, most of the other things that Poindexter's crowd has been doing is ranges from the ghoulish to the terrifying. But, you know, this is just further evidence that these guys shouldn't have a budget and shouldn't have anything to do with state power. They're really a threat to everything decent in the world.
You know, the Bush administration has always been extremely pro-free market, so it seems that involving the market and predicting acts of terrorism just seems like bringing that ideology to what they might consider its logical extreme.
Oh, yeah, I think these people have and certainly this is true of the Clinton administration, too. The Clinton administration was full of people who thought that the financial markets were wise and wonderful. So I think that that's one area where the two parties are pretty much in agreement. But, yeah, I think this is really a matter of a really close to a superstitious belief in the wisdom of markets, and really is pathological.
Doug Henwood is the editor of The Left Business Review and the host of Behind the News on Pacifica Station, WBAI, in New York. In one of only a few press conferences during his presidency, George Bush spoke with reporters today in the Rose Garden at the White House. The questions range from the budget deficit to the Supreme Court ruling overthrowing laws that interfere with the rights of privacy. There were many questions also about the war in Iraq. Specifically, Bush was asked why he led the country to war based on intelligence that has been discredited.
Saddam Hussein was a threat. The United Nations viewed him as a threat. That's why they passed 12 resolutions. Predecessors of mine viewed him as a threat. We gathered a lot of intelligence. That intelligence was good, sound intelligence on which I made a decision. And in order to, you know, placate the critics and the cynics about intentions of the United States, we need to produce evidence, and I fully understand that, and I'm confident that our search will yield that which I strongly believe, that Saddam had a weapons program. I want to remind you, he actually used his weapons program on his own people at one point in time, which is pretty tangible evidence. But I'm confident history will prove the decision we made to be the right decision.
Mr. President, you often speak about the need for accountability in many areas. I wonder then, why is Dr. Condoleezza Rice not being held accountable for the statement that your own White House has acknowledged was a mistake in your State of the Union address regarding Iraq's attempts to purchase uranium? And also, do you take personal responsibility for that inaccuracy?
I take personal responsibility for everything I say, of course. Absolutely. I also take responsibility for making decisions on war and peace. And I analyzed a thorough body of intelligence. Good, solid, sound intelligence that led me to come to the conclusion that it was necessary to remove Saddam Hussein from power. We gave the world a chance to do it. We had, remember this, again, I don't want to get repetitive here, but it's important to remind everybody that there was 12 resolutions that came out of the United Nations because others recognized the threat of Saddam Hussein. And the difference was is that some were not willing to act on those resolutions. We were, along with a lot of other countries, because he posed a threat. Dr. Condoleezza Rice is an honest, fabulous person, and America is lucky to have her service. Period.
President Bush speaking today in the Rose Garden at a press conference. The group Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity is calling for Vice President Dick Cheney's resignation over questionable intelligence data used to justify the invasion of Iraq. VIPS, as it's called, is made up of retired CIA agents who are critical of the Bush administration's justification for a so-called preemptive strike. Earlier this week, Peace Watch spoke with Ray McGovern, a spokesperson for the group living here in the Washington area. He dropped by the Peace Watch studios to discuss a memo they've issued demanding Dick Cheney step down as vice president. Today, we continue our conversation with McGovern.
Well, Colin Powell brags about the fact that he, as he puts it, spent 4 days and four nights at CIA going over that speech right before he delivered it on the 5th of February. Now, that is nothing short of bizarre. Do you mean to tell me that the Central Intelligence Agency didn't have its act together? That the CIA didn't have a wrap-up of all the evidence from which he could cull in his speech to the UN? That he had to go up there and search through the pieces and put it all together himself? And the notion that Condoleezza Rice joined him up there on a couple of occasions is doubly bizarre. Again, never in my experience for 27 years at the Central Intelligence Agency did a Secretary of State or an Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs come up to, quote, help, end quote, us with our analysis.
Everything that Secretary of State Colin Powell mm-hmm. said in that February 5th speech to the UN mm-hmm. was yeah. false.
The main charges about the nuclear preparations, the existence of chemical weapons, well, where are they? Where are all these leaders of anthrax? Where are they? I hope they haven't been stolen or given to real terrorists.
Why didn't they just come out and say, we can't stand by this stuff?
Well, the way the system works, Verna, is this art form, this national intelligence estimate, when there's one, you can call it recalcitrant, I would call it principled department or agency mm-hmm. that does not agree with the consensus, they are given the opportunity to have a footnote or to have an alternative view expressed, at the end of the 90 pages. Now, Condoleezza Rice has claimed that she never knew about State's footnote, and that's really hard to believe since the footnote occurred right up front. The text of the footnote didn't occur till later. So this is the art form. Now, Greg Thielman, who was a high intelligence official in the State Department, just retired last fall, he gives us the good news that those analysts felt free to speak out without fear or favor, and that even though their boss, Colin Powell, may have been taking a very different line, which of course he was, they felt that they had career protection and that Powell respected their adherence to the truth as they saw it. So, again, it's a supreme irony that they felt they had the protection and the folks in the CIA felt that they did not.
It's supposed to be the exact opposite, exactly. I would imagine. Your letter also says that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and not CIA Director George Tenet should be held responsible for the forged documents alleging that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger, ending up in Bush's State of the Union address. So was Tenet wrong to accept responsibility several weeks ago?
Well, that's really an interesting question, Vern. It's the $64 question. Strictly speaking, Condoleezza Rice is responsible for the national security segments of the State of the Union address. That much is clear. What George Tenet is claiming responsibility for, what he's apologizing for, is not catching the error. He's apologizing for being a rotten proofreader. He didn't catch the business that this stuff was reinserted back into their speech, even though it was totally discredited. Now, is George Tenet blameless? And here's another irony. Condoleezza Rice comes back and she says, well, we got that sentence right out of the estimate. And she did. What nobody seems to realize is that the estimate had already been cooked, had already been massaged to fit in with what Cheney and others wanted.
And so then Condoleezza Rice she's absolved of any blame then. She could say that she had no idea that this document was not, you know, a credible document. After all, it came from the intelligence agency. It was their estimate.
That's exactly right. And, well, if she can do that, it would be quite disingenuous on her part because she knew a lot more than she owns up to. But it is true that George Tenet, in this case, is hoisted on his own petard. He was playing a double game here. One of the interesting...
But let me ask you now, sure. Because you're familiar with these inner circles and how this stuff works, how many times can you pass that buck and still be politically credible?
Well, it depends on the public reaction. Right now, George Tenet and Condoleezza Rice seem to be secure in their jobs. They're just too useful to the administration, being right where they are. But if the press does not sublimate this, if the press continues to pursue this pursuit of what really happened back last fall, and the public starts getting interested, I mean, if my son were killed in Baghdad, I would be banging on the White House door saying, Mr. President, with all due respect, my son was sent there. Why was that? For weapons of mass destruction? And there aren't any? Would you tell me again, please, why my son was killed in Baghdad? Now multiply that by 200 or, God forbid, 1,000. And the American people are going to be waking up and they're going to be saying, were we conned? Let me add one other thing which sort of occurred to me over the weekend. George Tenet, very interestingly, in his, quote, apology, end quote, had a sentence here that has escaped media attention. I'll read it to you.
Please.
In the fall of 2002, my deputy and I briefed hundreds of members of Congress on Iraq. We did not brief the uranium acquisition story. Now that is really interesting, because that story was used with congressmen and senators to persuade them to vote for war. So Tenet is saying here that he and John McLaughlin, his deputy, did not use that.
Does he say why?
Well, the reason why comes out of John Dean's masterful wrap-up of the law on lying to or misleading Congress. It turns out that there is a law which makes it a felony to lie to Congress. George Tenet is a lawyer. George Tenet worked in the Senate side of the Intelligence Committee. And George Tenet knows that one of his predecessors, Richard Helms, was indicted for lying to Congress and pleaded nolo contendere, and it's the only way he avoided jail. So George Tenet, knowing how smelly this evidence was, instructed his deputy, and abided by his instruction himself, to avoid like the plague mentioning this evidence on the uranium from Niger, because it was already proved to have been bogus.
Well, you say avoided like the plague. Is that language that, is that specific quotes, or is that just your interpretation?
Well, again, it's a double game here. He says here that he and his deputy avoided briefing it on the Hill, but simultaneously with that, he allowed it to appear in the National Intelligence Estimate, which is his premier vehicle for communicating analysis with the president. So he acquiesced in that under great pressure from Vice President Cheney and others, and at the same time preserved his personal immunity, so to speak, by avoiding letting it come out from his personal mouth and briefing senators and representatives on the Hill. It's a really, really interesting set of circumstances.
So what happens if it's proven that George Bush lied to Congress through the State of the Union address?
Lie is a really emotionally charged word.
And difficult to prove,
yeah,
that he intentionally lied.
I will say this, though. Ambassador Joe Wilson, the one who was sent down to Niger to investigate this report, he's been through this ever since he got back in March of 2002. I've talked to Joe recently, and I will not quote him, but I have the distinct impression that Joe is so outraged by how this has been handled. Just see what he told the Washington Post reporters a couple of weeks ago when he said, you know, it begs the question of what else they're lying about. Now, here's a consummate diplomat permitting himself to say the word lie, and we can't really say that the president deliberately misled the nation in his State of the Union address, but if he was unaware of what was going on, I would just pose the question, which is worse, that he knew about it or that he didn't know about it? After all, what we're talking about here is a deliberate and successful attempt to deceive our elected representatives into voting to cede their power to make war to the President of the United States. That is, I would suggest, of a different magnitude from a sexual indiscretion in the White House or a third-rate burglary.
Ray McGovern is a spokesperson for Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. It's a group made up of retired CIA agents critical of the Bush administration's justification for the war. The Christmas coup comedy players of Pacifica Station KPFT of Houston and WBAI of New York specialize in political satire and offer this compilation of words of wisdom from the wise and the not so wise.
Fight the power!
Any society that would give up a little liberty to gain a little security will deserve neither and lose both.
Benjamin Franklin.
98% of the adults in this country are decent, hard-working, honest Americans. It's the other lousy 2% that get all the publicity, but then we elected them. Lily Tomlin. Without a struggle, there can be no progress. Frederick Douglass. One man with courage is a majority. Thomas Jefferson. Democracy is the most vile form of government. Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. James Madison. A witty saying proves nothing. Voltaire. Moderation in temper is always a virtue, but moderation in principle is always a vice. Thomas Paine. Revolution is a serious thing. The most serious thing about a revolutionary's life, when one commits oneself to the struggle, it must be for a lifetime. Angela Davis. A lifetime of training for just 10 seconds. Jesse Owens. If you give a person a fish, they'll fish for a day. But if you train a person to fish, they'll fish for a lifetime. Dan Quayle. That's all a man can hope for during his lifetime, to set an example. And when he is dead, to be an inspiration for history. William McKinley.
The Christmas Coup, comedy players of Pacifica Stations KPFT of Houston and WBAI of New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.